accession number 20590, Reel 3.
Norman Mitchell, Reel 3. So what was your parents' reaction when you walked in?
Well, they were quite shocked, in actual fact, because it was in the early hours of the morning. And but obviously very well. I was made very welcome, quite naturally. Mm. But I spent a few days there visiting relatives, which is the normal thing to do in those days, and had various celebrations as far as you could.
What was it? Obviously, wartime, you've gone on for
wartime,
a few years.
Yeah,
What food was available? What could you
sell? Well, you were still right. Obviously, rationing was still pretty tight. You know, sugar and butter and things like that were very, very tightly rationed. And meat, I mean, oof. But you used to get a ration certificate, you see. But then, of course, I went home without.
Yeah. So what did your mother manage to get together for Christmas?
Oh, it's a long time ago. I think we had a reason. She managed to get hold of a chicken, and we celebrated quite well. Although, as I say, I had no ration things, so they managed somehow.
Mm. So, were you all home? How many children?
Well, yes. Well, there was me, my two younger ones, Fred and Pat. They'd been evacuated because of the bombing of Bristol, but they're getting into 43, of course, the bombing had stopped, and they were back home. They were evacuated to a little village of Huish Episcopi near Taunton. And because prior to being called up, my father and I used to go down. Father had a motorcycle, and we used to go down and visit them. But they were home. My eldest sister was there. Of course, my elder brother, Horace, is already gone. So it was a bit sad in its way, but on the other hand, you know, I was home, and that was it.
Were you aware this was your sort of, you know, last Christmas, the last
Christmas, yes,
of the family,
yeah,
before you went?
Before anything happened, yeah. Mm. I didn't find out properly, really, until I think I was in March when the whole thing. I don't know how I found out. I honestly don't know, but I did. And
you found out the actual date?
Roughly the dates, yeah. Yeah.
So, were you training all this time then in Maidstone?
Yes.
Seriously?
Oh, yes, yeah, quite seriously, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Were you being taught anything new than you'd been practicing?
Well, no, I'd been trained. See, at the Armoured Car Regiment training, I'd been trained. You were trained there, you see, on armoured cars to drive, wireless operate, gunnery, map reading. That the spell I was there, it was very good training. But then when I got to base, of course, I did this partly driving old Davidor's armoured car, and then I got the sack from that and went on to the water truck. So my main job with when the exercises, because you leave everything, you pack everything, you leave camp, and they'd go off, you know, and then one would be with the squadron headquarters, where the squadron leader and his office clerk, plus the quartermaster, the cooks, and anybody else that was in headquarters, of which I was part of headquarters, of squadron headquarters staff. And then, of course, we would then go out with, I mean, half the time they didn't need the water because they were already somewhere or the other and could get water straight from the tap, which they considered to be far safer than getting out of my water cart. Dear.
So was there any sort of pecking order of these different jobs and sections, or, you know, were some considered more glamorous and some less important?
Oh, the armoured car troops were always considered the elite. They always considered themselves better than the carrier troops.
Why was that?
Well, I assume they had to do all the jobs. You had to be able to drive, you had to be able to operate the radio, fire the gun, and also map read command if needed be. Carrier troops weren't quite that way so far. As long as a couple of them, they all used to be able to drive the carriers, but they were always considered not quite so well qualified as the armoured car men.
Right. So how did you feel about your job then?
Well, I could, it was essential. And for a while, I lost the job because Peter Coburn, or Philip Coburn, I can't remember, the squadron, who decided that he wanted me to drive his Jeep when the Jeeps came over. So,
what was the reaction to the Jeep?
Oh, the new animal altogether, that was, yeah, left-hand drive and all. Quite something.
So you felt pleased to have
that? I felt pleased with that, yeah, especially when I got the old man in the... Yeah. Well, the old man, we always call it the old man. In there, and we on the exercises, of course, I couldn't take part in them. I drove him, and where all the exercises were set up, because I know where everything was, whereas the guys that were coming to take part in the exercise... the defenders were in places where I know they were. I mean, they're not good at all, so I didn't have to do any of that.
Why do you think you were chosen as a driver?
Don't know. Mm. No idea.
No. So what did you learn about your officer, Coburn?
As I say, he was a typical schoolmaster. Mm. Oh, you could, you know, if you saw him, oh yeah, old PC. I think he had a school somewhere north of Oxford somewhere, I believe, to my knowledge. He was a head there, I believe, yeah. And he used to treat us all like his schoolboys, you see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you get an idea of what his daily duties involved then while you were driving him? What did he do all day, if it's not a silly question?
Well, if you've got a squadron of 190-odd, well, they'd be 180-odd people, you know. They do take a lot of looking after.
So what would he be doing? Driving about, where would he be going?
Well, he in actual fact would be going up to see exactly how the various troop officers and the troops went about the various jobs, the jobs that they were set. And it was, you know, all sorts of things when they drove when they were harbouring their vehicles, how they harboured, how safe they were, how quick they got the camouflage nets on, and how they organised the guard on wherever they were and so on. And they were always getting marked out of 10 for this, you see. And at the end, it was totted up and the meeting was had and criticisms were given. Dear, oh dear.
So while you were driving him, did you get any sort of confidential insights into what was going on?
I think this is where I managed to, gather the information which I had. Because they were, we moved out of Mason. I can't think what it was, but down to Ashford, and we're stationed at Hatch Park, which is the residence of the Braeburn family.
What was that like?
Oh, well, I wasn't stationed in the big house. That was regimental headquarters and headquarters squadron. The headquarters, with the reconnaissance regiment, you've got three, what we call three fighting squadrons, which consists of armoured cars, carrier troops, and an assault troop. Squadron headquarters consisted of the mortar troop and the anti-tank troop. And then, of course, regimental headquarters were all the regimental staff, colonel, adjutant, and all the other ancillary things that make it to run the regiment. And they were all stationed at Hatch Park. We were stationed at a little place called... Braeburn Lees, which I was just had a load of Nissen huts, and we were billeted in them.
Were you able all this time? Did you keep in contact with home?
Oh yes, I would write. I would write regularly home. Yeah. Oh yes. At least once a week.
Yeah. And why did you do that specifically?
Why? Well, knowing the situation with the family, with my brother having gone, I felt that I had to do it, and not because I had to do it, but we were a fairly close family, and that was it. I had no girlfriends, you see. I mean, I wasn't allowed girlfriends.
Who, by your mother?
Mother. Little did she know.
So you started looking at girls by this time.
Oh, well, before we left school, yeah, the last year of Fairfield. Well, that was the best years of our life, that. I mean, absolutely amazing.
So, I mean, all this time you've been training in England, I mean, did you have a girlfriend?
I had a girlfriend. I had a young lady at, when we were stationed at Braeburn Lease, yes. And she was the young lady that used to deliver the milk. She was the milk girl. And we got I was on guard one day and we got talking. And it was a very good arrangement because her father was the landlord of the pub, the Five Bells. And it was very useful to have a contact with her because ale was very short in those days. And they only used to get a delivery once a week, and it was never the same day. And so if you knew the landlord's daughter, you knew when supplies were coming in.
So they actually ran out during the week, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
What could you drink then?
Oh, nothing much.
Soft drinks
and that sort of thing. But half the time they didn't bother. They'd just shut, and that was it.
Yeah. So was she a serious girlfriend?
Not really. No. It was just the contact with the pub.
Yeah. Social.
Yeah. Don't ask. And you know, it's difficult to say. I can't even remember her name.
Mm.
There you are. I remember her sister, Myrtle, but that was an exceptional name.
Yeah.
And my old John Lowe, who and I were quite good friends, he was courting going out with the one, I was going out with the other. So we were well versed in when the pub was had supplies. It's that useful.
So how do you sort of, everyone in your billet squadron, whatever. Had you also piled up in different sort of social groups within, you know, that you had your friends?
You usually had a particular some people you could get on with. I mean, John Lowe, I got to know quite well. He came from up the Midlands somewhere, and we used to go around together, just the two of us, because at that stage I'd lost me stripe.
Why did you lose
you? Well, I came back from leave one day and went on the sick parade with a pair of brown shoes on. Oh, dear. My kit. The squadron had moved in the meantime and my kit was obviously all gone in. When I came back, it was somewhere else. And I think dear old Doc Davis, the sergeant major, and I did get on. he never had any time for anybody who was without being big-headed about it, anybody that was educated, he had no time for. And there were quite a few of us. And he had no time for us. And of course, the old Corporal Mitchell there with his brown shoes on was on, pegged immediately and was reduced to the ranks.
So what did you think about that? I wasn't bothered.
Well, I wasn't being paid for it.
Right.
Doing it for nothing.
What did your colleagues say about it? Did they find it funny?
They thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Well, you know, can't order us about now. No, they were good. They were quite a pleasant, quite a good crowd. Well, we'd been there, you know, in the 44. We'd been there a long time. They'd known us, you know. But the funny thing was, when I went on the course at Maidstone, the driver mechanics course, I came out of that with flying colours, and the colonel said, well, I had to go up before him. We'd like to promote you back again. And I said, no, thank you. He asked me why. I said, well, if you ask the Sergeant Major, if you ask Sergeant Major Davis, I'm sure he'll tell you why.
And why would that be?
Well, he just didn't like people that... seriously, he didn't like people that were educated. And he showed it, too. He really was a bit of a brute, actually, yeah. But eventually he left us, and took over headquarters squadron, and we got Squadron Sergeant Major Mackey. He was the he was a quartermaster, so he was a Scotsman, and he took over as Squadron Sergeant Major. We got on a lot better then.
And he went with you to Normandy.
He came with us into Normandy because we were the 53rd Welsh Division. You see, weren't part of the initial assault. They didn't. I think the division didn't go out until late June. I didn't go out till late July.
Oh. So part of the build-up. Ashford, was it?
In Ashford, and prior to going over, we were in Moat Park, Maidstone. I can't think when we moved there. And then, of course, all the preliminary run-up to waterproofing vehicles, so in case you landed in water, they'd drive through, and all that sort of thing was done. All these various exercises and all the extra things they were issued with, how to... These little stoves that were absolutely damn useless, absolutely bloody useless.
What were they called?
I don't know what they were called. Some, they had tablets there or sorry, the other to light, but they're absolutely useless. Absolutely useless.
So you were getting quite a bit of new bits and bobs of equipment.
New bits and bobs. Equipment was pretty readily available, you know. Spare parts for vehicles that broke down. Oh, well, they were, you know, when, prior to the run-up to us being loaded to go to France. But we drove from Maidstone, from Moat Park, into London, into East India Dock. Right through London with a police escort.
Right. So, just going back to, how did you hear about when you were going? You know, was it an order came through? Or?
Well, a squadron, B squadron, under old Davidor Goldsmith, they went out before us. They went out with the initial part of the division in, which I think was the end of June.
Right. So you'd heard about.
We knew about them. We knew they were out there. We knew they'd had casualties and so on, and. That I think we knew about a week before when we were due to be embarked. So we went up to East India Docks.
So it was quite real now, this, wasn't it?
Oh, this was real, yeah. And, of course, whilst we were there down in Ashford, of course, the old flying bombs started coming over. Yeah. Remember getting out one, what the hell was that? The noise, you know, the rocket motor on it, yeah. And then, of course, eventually. And, of course, that we were in what they call used to call Buzz Bomb Alley. They're coming up through there. I mean, the unique thing, I don't know if you know about these flying bombs, these V1s. Well, the whole there was a slight defect in them. When it ran out of fuel, the engine would stop and he'd come straight down, you see. So what you hoped the God was that the engine would pack up after it had gone past. But, of course, many times it didn't. And, of course, when we were in the East India Docks, we had quite a few of these things come over landing in the dock area, and one as we eventually decided, one very lucky fellow, SQMS Jimmy Haig, this buzz bomb came over and the engine went, you know, we all, I think a dozen people dived into a slit trench. It was only made for six. Jimmy was at the bottom and suffered a broken ankle. So Jimmy didn't come with us, did he? He stayed at home.
So you drove in convoy then?
Yeah, convoy, yeah, through by metro.
Can you remember that journey?
We were on our way then, yeah. I think the devastation through the east part of London was quite dramatic. You know, we'd seen bombing. I'd seen the result of the bombing in Bristol, and whilst Maidstone and Ashford were never seriously bombed anyway, I think you might get the odd one. And the odd flying bomb would come down through. But the majority of the flying bombs all landed in open country. They were shot down. Some were shot down. There wasn't the devastation. But coming into London from up through, I think it's the tunnel, Blackfriars Tunnel, is it? In London? Yeah, I think it was Blackfriars Tunnel. We came up through there and into the East India Docks, of all places, yeah.
So what were the East India Docks looking
like? Absolutely devastated. Hardly any. There's one of the odd buildings here and there. And then, of course, we had to wait then for the ship to come in, the John E. Ward, a Liberty ship.
Mm-hmm. Did you see many of the East End people? I mean, were they about? Did you get an impression of how life was going on?
What, you mean with the civilians? Mm. Well, if you were starting, when we were on our way up, coming through, you'd have to stop sometimes. And, you know, they'd... oh, yes, they'd come over and chat with you and offer you tea and coffee and cakes and one thing and another, yeah, and said, you know, and I think the classic was one chap that is in the book there where one of our lads, they stopped and this chap was stood there in front of the house absolutely devastated, and he said, hey, give him one for me, will you, when you get over. This is typical East End humour, you know, it's terrific.
So you stayed at the dock?
At the dock for, I think it was 2 days, I think we were there. My first experience. Oh no, only just sheds. Yes, my first experience of trying to sleep in a hammock. That was an education.
Right, and then then you got on board?
Loaded on board, yeah. All the vehicles went into the bottom. One armoured car was dropped, and they didn't see the light of the day after. They dropped out of the slings that they used to put them up in there. They got them in there properly, yeah. And it dropped on the side, which was a disaster. And we then we moved out to the dock, and there was only the dockers to wave us goodbye. Yeah. Except we got to one stage, and there were some children, kids there, waving to us. And so we were literally shelling all our small change, because all the small change we were throwing onto the docks, and they were collecting it. Mm. Whether they had that and they'd done that for days, we don't know, but quite sunny, yeah.
So what was the Liberty ship like?
Desperate. Food was short. Went all the way down the Thames, you see, around and crossed at the shortest place across over onto the Mulberry, or well, not the Mulberry, just off the Mulberry. But food was desperately short. Yeah, yeah. Consisted mainly, there was a lot of corned beef, bully, hard biscuits, and vegetable mayonnaise was the main diet for the main meal of the day. Oh, dear.
So how long were you on the ship, and what time did your day...
I can't quite recall. It didn't take very long to get down there. We were anchored off there one night, and then the following day... things started to move, because you then had to offload the vehicles and ourselves onto smaller landing ships, you know, that for the run in up to the beach. Yeah. Well, we had one or two interesting things in the evening when a little minesweeper came up and tied up alongside. You know, they were having a break, and a lot of banter went on between us and them. Somebody suggested they'd lost the winder, you know, the key. Oh, dear. I wonder what happened to them lads. Yeah, they were minesweeping in the area.
So you transferred from the Liberty ship
onto a landing craft, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So adrenaline running then?
No, not really. I don't think nobody got overexcited about it. But I'm not that sort of person. I feel very matter of fact. Yeah. Well.
So you could see the coast of France.
Oh, yeah. And the most impressive thing was whilst we were anchored off there during the day to see the old HMS Warspite going up and down the coast, throwing all the rubbish in. Yeah, he's like, keep it going, George. Yeah. The sound of that going over the top of you is quite dramatic. Very low-pitched. Whoa.
Sorry, what were they throwing?
Oh, 15-inch shells slinging over the top, you know. And he's steaming up and down, you know, and I watched a couple of cruisers, I think, throwing stuff in as well. And you could even at that stage, although you could hear them land. You're most impressive.
So
when we landed, about that much water. Dear.
6 inches.
Yeah. 6 inches of water, yeah. And then, of course, you get off, and the first thing you do at the top of the beach is take the... You've got a ground sheet around the front to stop the water coming in the radiator, rip off all the this compound that you had around the plugs and so on and so forth, just take it off roughly, and then drive off into an assembly area. God, it looked like Kempton Park on race day. Never seen so many vehicles in all your life. Right. It was a good job the German Air Force was not about.
Yeah. Mm. So what was the state of the... Where
is it exactly? In a field, just off of Gracier Mare, which is on the coast of Normandy. And, then we'd rip off all the waterproofing and stuff and that sort of thing, get the, and then form up and rendezvous at a certain point. Whilst we were there, certain people from B Squadron arrived, you know, old sweats. And they informed us, oh no, Jerry's still about 8 miles away, so we thought, oh, well, we should live for a few days yet, you know.
What was the state of the territory there? I mean, there were villages, there were towns, were they?
The local railway line had all been ripped up. That is, when you see the D-Day reminiscence on, you'll see that railway line. It's all up in the air, and the signal box there. You see that? Mm. Landed right there.
What impression did you get of the scale of the fighting that had gone on in that area?
Well, it's obvious that, you know, there had been a lot of damage, a lot of damage, and there were very few civilians about, in actual fact. When we eventually got into our first area, we were outside the aerodrome at Carpique, which the Canadians had captured that, a lot of heavy fighting a bit early on. We, in actual fact, were on the outskirts, not in the actual club. It's all devastated anyway. And we were, our little headquarters, squadron headquarters, we were pulled up and we just dug our trenches and got our bits of corrugated iron over the top. And not that it'll save us from anything, but it...
So were the Canadians still there?
No. Canadians had moved on.
First night in the field then?
That was our first night in Normandy, yeah. Yes, mm. Yes. And then, of course, the following day, the the carrier troops and the armoured, some of the armoured car personnel, the armoured cars were left because it was in a holding role then. The line, the bridgehead had been established, okay, and was held by infantry of the division. The recce job then was to go up and take over certain sections of the main front from the infantry, let them come back for a rest.
Right.
And I think our first experience was at a hill called Hill 112, which is quite well known to everybody in 12 Corps, the British divisions. We used to call it Sausage Hill. It was Hill 112, a very well known place.
So and you were in your water carrier?
I was in the water carrier there, and then wherever the troops were, it was my job each day to A, go and fill up the water point. You had to find out where the water point was, which the Royal Engineers would set up with their big canvas tanks, you see. And if you could get there and get them to fill you up, it saved a lot of bother. Saved you priming the filters and everything else. So one used to use all sorts of excuses. Oh, and the pump's out of action at the moment. And then they'd fill you.
So did you have an idea of the strategy that was going on?
Oh, yes. Yeah, one great thing about... And I think this was partly, I understand, I don't know for a fact, but I understand it was partly due to Montgomery's idea that everybody must know exactly what's happening and when, right down to the last, like me at the bottom of the pile. Yeah.
So how did they tell you? I mean,
Yeah, the officers go to the O group, they're their O group, and they would then come back and brief us as to what was happening. Yeah.
And was it an optimistic tone to all this?
It was never looked upon lightly, because we knew darn well to break out of that bridgehead was going to be no holiday, and it wasn't.
Did you have an idea of the scale of casualties?
Oh yes, we knew what was going on. Yeah, yeah. When the breakout did occur, the armoured car troops took a hell of a hammering. In actual fact, yeah, desperate hammering they took, and it was at that stage that I was then transferred from the. Because I had somebody else with me in the water truck who hadn't been trained in armoured cars, and I was then transferred to an armoured car troop. And then I got down to the real business of fighting.
Norman Mitchell, end of Reel 3.
Mm.